Today's Monday, March 12th. The quorum being present.
Committee on Local Government Elections will come to order. The first bill on the agenda is Senate File 2334, Senator Vandeveer. You have any amendments, Senator?
Yes, Mr. Chair, of the A1 amendment. Read everything.
Everybody has the A1 amendment. Senator Vandeveer, to your amendment, please.
Amendment just gets the bill in the shape I'd like it in.
Any discussion? See none. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment prevails. Senator Vandeveer, to your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What this bill does is clarifies the reporting requirements of principles and administrative actions. It requires that they be broken out separately so that the reader would get a clearer view of the proportion of the spending on administrative actions. And here to explain the need for the bill is Mr. Evans.
Mr. Evans, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. The bill's fairly simple, and I think Senator Vandeveer explained it about as well as it can be explained. Just to add a little more detail, there are three things that are listed in Minnesota statutes as administrative action which apply only to the work of public utilities, and those are rate cases, the routing and siting of power lines and power plants, and something called a certificate of need, which is a document or a proceeding that we need to file in order to construct facilities for our business. And for quite some time now, those have been required to be reported as part of administrative action, but really are quite a bit separate and different from anything that anyone else reports. And so it seemed to us that it would be appropriate for those to be reported separately so that when one looks at the total number that's reported as lobbying expenditures, these items which are really unique to utilities would be separated out. So they'll be fully reported just as they always have been, but in fact they'll be separated out from the rest of the lobbying expenses so that when you look at the total lobbying expenses for any company, utility or otherwise, in the state, you'll really be comparing apples to apples. And then there's one subset of things that are reported only by utilities will be reported separately, and so as not to sort of skew the data. We've spoken with the Board of Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board, and I don't think they're going to be here to testify today, but they agree that this would make this a more transparent process and have told us that they can make this change without any added expense or cost by the board.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Any questions for Mr. Evans? We have another testifier, Mike Dean. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Dean. Please
Thank
state
you.
Your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mike Dean. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota. We're a government watchdog group. And I'm here to raise some concerns about this. However, some of the concerns I did have were just addressed by the A1 amendment. So I have fewer concerns. But just to start off, you know, really I'm concerned that we are weakening Minnesota's lobby rules. I think Minnesota, unfortunately, has some fairly weak lobby rules already on the books. And unfortunately, you see that Americans have become very angry with a deep disconnect with their leaders here in St. Paul. It's really easy to see why. While hardworking families really continue to struggle, we see wealthy special interests are writing legislation behind closed doors. And so I think this legislation is slightly misguided in that really what we should be doing is strengthening the lobby laws that exist right now. Really, I think lobbyists have too much power. If you look at, and I realize I'm in a room full of lobbyists right now, but I think there are huge concerns right now, and I would just urge the body to really step back and think about ways that we can actually strengthen this. There are, unfortunately, too many loopholes that exist within the current lobby laws right now, and there's a lot of information that currently is being or is going undisclosed. And so I think this creates some confusion around that, creates the potential for a loophole, but I think the priority is unfortunately somewhat misguided in that we should really be looking at ways to strengthen the rules instead of really weaken them. So with that, I'll end.
Thank you, Mr. Dean. Senator Stephen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Dean, while I appreciate your comments, I think that, in fact, the A1 amendment actually helps to strengthen the transparency of reporting in that right now, as Mr. Evans testified to, power plant, power line siting, granting of certificates of need, all of those costs are incorporated into the lobbying expenses that the company reports, thereby giving the public a skewed understanding of the actual dollars that are spent lobbying here at the Capitol. So, you know, while I appreciate your comments, I think that this is actually a pretty straightforward amendment that that I would urge members to support.
Mr. Dean?
As I started out with my statements, again, I think that the A1 amendment did address most of my concerns. Initially, this was a broad exemption for utilities to not have to disclose this type of administrative rulemaking lobbying. I think the A1 addresses that. My concern more is just with why the exemption exists for everyone else. I actually believe that everyone should have to disclose this type of activity. Why are we forcing just Excel to do this? And so I think there needs to be broader disclosure when it comes to these rules, specifically when you look at what's going on with activities around the healthcare exchange. It's highly likely that there's going to be a process around the healthcare exchange law that currently is not being disclosed, but that's definitely lobbying that's going on. There's also activities with the Campaign Finance Disclosure Board itself, where there are individuals that sit before them, ask for advice, and to a certain extent lobby that board for opinions on different rules. That currently is not considered lobbying under the current statute, and so I think we should extend it to be much broader than what it is right now.
Thank you, Mr. Dean. Any other questions for Mr. Dean? Thank you, Mr. Dean.
Thank you.
Would anyone else like to testify either for or against Senate File 2334? Any further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Van de Veer moves that Senate File 2334 be recommended pass and placed on general orders. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you, Senator Van de Veer. The motion passed. Place on the general orders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and member.
Second bill on the agenda is Senator Gazelka, Senate File 1753. Senator Gazelka, welcome to the committee. Do you have any amendments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is an author's amendment, I believe. I'm hoping somebody will move.
Moves the A2 amendment, is that correct? A4? Does everyone have the A4 amendment?
Mr. Chair, hang on a second. Sure, I got the right one here. That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Discussion to the A4 amendment. None. All those in favor for the A4 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. Amendments adopted. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This legislation was birthed out of a situation in Crow Wing County, the area I represent, related to a mentally handicapped person that ended up voting, even though he was under guardianship and should not have voted. I really don't want to place blame on anyone. I just want to correct the problem. So Mary Kiffmeyer has been working on this on the House side, and I'm working on the Senate side. I can tell you there are different groups, I believe, that are in support of this, the aging services, long-term care providers, courts, I'm not sure if we have anybody passionately opposed to it anymore. I don't know that. But so when that person was brought to vote, and frankly, it was not even a party vote, just so everybody here knows, it was a local election. And that person, not even barely knowing his name and functioning as about a 12-year-old, it showed us that there was a gap in the system. His name was Steen, because you're going to have a letter from his mom. But Steen was under guardianship and should not have voted. In the Constitution, it says in Section 7, Article 7, that guardianship, you should not vote. And yet, in 2003, statute says guardianship can vote. So there was a conflict there. This part of this bill will clear that up. We're forming something called limited guardianship. So guardianship will clearly not be able to vote according to the Constitution. Limited guardianship may be able to vote, depending on what the courts decide. And it gives that person some dignity to say, I'm under limited guardianship and I can vote. The fiscal note is zero on this as well. So if I can just take a quick walkthrough, Section 1, and I'll say I made notes on the old version, and the new version lists the sections different. So I'm going to just take the way the amendments adopted. Section 1 differentiates between the individual under guardianship and those under limited guardianship. Those under guardianship are now not eligible to vote, which lines up to Article 7 of the Minnesota Constitution. Section 2 modifies the voter's registration application to make the same distinction in Section 1 between those under guardianship and limited guardianship. Section 3 is new. This was an amendment from the House that removes jury selection lists from the requirements regarding what data must not be included. Section 4 requires the state court administrator to report to the Secretary of State individuals that were placed under limited guardianship in which the court revokes the right to vote. The Secretary of State must report annually to the chair and ranking members of the House and Senate election committees on the number of individuals in each county whose registration is changed pursuant to this section. And that basically, if we're going to pass new legislation, I think it's appropriate for the legislative bodies to be able to follow up on what we've done. Section 5 adds a reference on the polling place roster regarding individuals under limited guardianship in which the individual's rights to vote have been revoked by the court. Section 6 amends the Bill of Rights for wards and protects persons to say that an individual placed under guardianship is not entitled to vote, and an individual placed under a limited guardianship retains the right to vote unless otherwise ordered by the court. Section 7 requires a court, as part of making an order to appoint a guardian, to explicitly declare whether the order establishes a guardianship or limited guardianship. If it establishes a limited guardianship, the order must state the effect of the order on the ward's right to vote. In other words, we're asking the court to give clarity here, similar to what they do in many other areas, include health care, et cetera. Within 2 weeks after the appointment of a guardian, the guardian must send a copy of the appointed order to the ward's current address unless the guardian resides with the ward. The mailing must be addressed to the ward and any administrator of the facility where the ward lives. A new copy of the order, along with any changes in the order, must be sent within 30 days of any changes of the address by the ward. Section 8 provides conforming changes related to the eligibility of individuals under guardianship and limited guardianship. Again, that's the clarification that Article 7 of the Constitution says guardianship should not vote. Section 9 modifies the annual reporting of a guardian to the court. Subdivision 1 provides that the guardian's annual report to the court must include a recommendation on whether the ward's eligibility to vote should be rescinded, restored, or remained unchanged. Again, this report already sent to the courts, but it adds this provision. Subdivision 2 is important. It provides that if the guardian report indicates a change in the ward's capacity to make independent voting decisions, the court may issue an order as to the ward's eligibility to vote. In other words, we want to provide every opportunity for that person. If their health improves, if something changes, that the court can come in and change it so that they have the right to vote on short notice. Section 10 establishes duties of the residential facility that provides housing to a ward. The facility must maintain all documents submitted to the facility by a guardian that relates to the ward's guardianship status and eligibility to vote. It maintains a list of the wards residing in the facility and the current voting eligibility of each, and ensures that the staff assisting wards in the voting process only assist those who are eligible to vote. So we're trying to correct that problem. If they're under guardianship, they should not be voting. If they're limited guardianship and the court has given them approval to vote, the facility will know and they can help those people vote. Section 11 requires the state court administrator to annually provide each guardian with a notice that restates the current voter eligibility status of the guardian's ward. So, and finally, we picked the date of August 2nd, 2012. So, Mr. Chair, members, that's the bill as an overview. I know there's testifiers for and against as well, and I'll stand for questions.
Thank you. Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Keeley.
Is there a fiscal note?
No, the fiscal note is zero.
How can that be with the courts having to do more reporting?
Senator Gazelka, we have a note from the Secretary of State. It's not, the fiscal note isn't complete yet, but that there would be some small costs in the first year.
Mr. Chair, members, I apologize.
But this is going to judiciary, so.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, I work in this field, and I know that right now everybody has a guardian. And sometimes it's just guardian of person. Sometimes it's guardian of finances or whatever. So when this goes into effect, anybody who has any kind of guardianship will be under a guardian. So no, there won't be any limited guardianships. So nobody could vote until the courts went through everybody and made that determination. Is that not correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Eaton, I know that I believe there's a number now that are under that would need to be transferred to limited guardianship. That's why we set the dates of August or June 1st, the effective date for the initial list required to be sent out, and then August 12th, notification of voting eligibility status of current guardians no later than August 1st. The state court administrator should provide to each guardian a notice restating the current voting eligibility. So we're trying to move it up as fast as we can, but that is, so there will clearly be guardianships where it is absolutely clear that they shouldn't have been voting and now definitely can't vote, and others will move into limited guardianship.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you. My concern is that you're giving 6-7 months for the courts to clean up all the records of everybody who's on guardianship. And most of the people I know on guardianship are not like your example here. Most of them have issues with either having to make serious medical decisions or whatever that they feel they needed help with. So most people vote who have guardianship other than those with severe developmental disabilities. So we could have a whole group of people who, because of their guardianship, could not vote next election.
Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, Senator Eatman, and members, first of all, we would want their wards to be, guardian or care provider to be involved in this process. It's absolutely is not our intent to restrict somebody that should be voting to be voting. We want them to be voting. But we definitely want to, and I'm going to have a testifier come and share a personal story and the frustration related to that when somebody that absolutely should not have been voting was taken down to vote to affect a local election. That's what I think is really beneficial of this particular example. It has nothing to do with the two major parties. It's an issue that we need to deal with. And so I appreciate your concern, and my attempt is to make sure that that process is handled in a way that everybody that should be voting absolutely should be voting.
Would that be okay, members, if we listen to the testimony he's referring to? And we could come back to
thank you.
Additional questions. Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, I handed out some material. One of the pieces of information I handed out to you was from the district attorney of Crow Wing County, because he was the one that was involved in this case and did not process it or prosecute it, held a grand jury, and nothing went forward. But the letter there clearly indicates that it could have been handled differently if we had some clarity in the law. So I think it would be very helpful for all of you to read that letter as well.
The members have the letter in their back.
Yes.
Did you testify here? Can you state your name for the tape, please?
It's Ron Kaus.
Thank you. Proceed with your testimony.
My name's Ron Kaus. I'm from Duluth, Minnesota. Recently moved there. I used to live in Crow Wing County for 25 years, and I was very intimately involved in this Crow Wing case from the very beginning. As I was called on the Saturday just before the 2010 election, and Mahdi Jensen reported to me that he had witnessed disabled people being used inappropriately for voting. It looked like they were totally incapacitated. He said some of them didn't know where they were, it looked like. And he had witnessed it with another person as they were waiting to vote absentee. He initially called the county attorney, who was unavailable, but he called me because we were involved with voting integrity before that, so in the military vote. But anyway, what he witnessed was several different things. People being told how to vote. In one case, one person went back to the voting booth, and the caregiver took the ballot out of their hands, and the disabled person just kept going. And when she couldn't get him to return to the voting booth, she filled out the ballot, went and got him, and then turned in the ballot. And that was what really sparked him. And he went and challenged it at the counter to no avail. They just said, well, they have a right to vote and that sort of thing. Well, that set out a research project for me and others, and we started looking into it, exactly what had happened and who voted and, you know, what their voting status may or may not have been. And as I started to research it, I started to cross voter lists with adult foster care facility addresses and found on one adult foster care facility 22 people who had voted. So I took that and then went to the judiciary website and drilled down and found out that there were 16 under guardianship. Seven were said to be mentally incapacitated. And one of those people was my good friend James Steen, who was at my wedding. I've known him for 20 years. And anyone who knows James Steen knows he can't vote. He's incompetent. I've helped to care for him and his family. We went to church together and that sort of thing. So I called, and James has always been a hero of mine. When he was 12, he dove in to the water to save his sister from drowning, saved her, but nearly drowned himself and suffered a traumatic brain injury. And so I've always lifted him up as one who has given his life for another person and always kind of looked out for his well-being. So when I saw this, I was very troubled. I called his parents. His parents were infuriated at what had happened. They were never asked permission. They were never informed that they were taking him to vote. And as guardians, they were never going to take him to vote because they knew he was incompetent. In fact, his dad said, if I took him to vote, I'd just be getting two votes. I'd be exploiting him for my own purposes. So Al Steen filed a complaint. And ironically, he ended up pulling his son out of the county, and he died 1 year of a heart attack 1 year from when his son was exploited on the 29th of October. So anyway, my research shows that not only was the 2003 bill, in my view, totally unconstitutional, which is troubling from a citizen standpoint, but it also, there was widespread non-compliance with the 2003 unconstitutional law as it was then executed, at least in the Crow Wing County and the research that we have done on the 16 individuals. We found that 12 of them were pre-2003 guardianship people. And if you were pre-2003, you had no right to vote. Out of that 12 that were pre-2003, four actually had judge court orders revoking their right to vote. and we found that they had voted in that election. And that is exactly what Monty Jensen saw. As we went back through the records and found the timestamps of when they voted, they were right in front of him, and that's what he saw. So it just brings up the fact that I think that the widespread noncompliance is much more widespread than we think it is, not only in Crow Wing County, but I went and talked to the court administrator who said when we asked whether these people and these individuals had voting rights, they said, well, and whether they're under guardianship, they go, well, these records are really confusing. You're going to have to talk to the expert, which I'm like going, wow. You know, from an average citizen standpoint, I have to talk to the expert in that area to find out. And so she explained it and why it was so confusing because of the 2003 law and that sort of thing. So the other thing that I found is that the noncompliance opened up the vulnerable adults to other ways to be violated, not only voter registration fraud, as we found in this, or voter registration falsification, as I say, ineligible voting, identity theft possibly, involuntary servitude, as we saw possibly in the local election up there in Crow Wing County, and a number of other things, and possibly political predation, you know, predators, actually looking for vulnerable people to use them for political purposes to help their political, whoever they wanted to be in office. So I am speaking in favor of this bill today, and I'm glad for Mr. Gazelka, Senator Gazelka's, all of his work he's done on this. I know he's kept in tune with this, and I think that it would help to build a fence, again, for protection for the vulnerable adults, James Steen and others.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, the testifier, you said this 2003 bill is unconstitutional. Was it declared unconstitutional?
No, it's ironic because, you know, the Constitution says that you can't be under guardianship and be eligible to vote. And then the 2003 bill says, oh, you can be under guardianship and vote as long as a court has not found your...
So you're... saying it's unconstitutional is your opinion, not the Supreme Court's decision.
Correct. Yeah.
Mr. Croft.
Just to follow up, is there any reason why this hasn't been challenged? So that.
No, but we recently did. So we did put together a lawsuit to challenge it to just citizens. I was hoping that the system would take care of itself, but as private citizens, we raised some money to challenge that.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I will say my focus is this bill. There was a variety of parties and players in what happened up in Crow Wing County, and I, you know, I don't want to move into allegations, who is at fault, whatever. I recognize that if we improve the law, we don't have the things that happened up there. And just as a personal note, I'm pretty sure the guy had my sign up too. So it's, you know, I want to say it had nothing to do with politics at the higher level, but we could see that this was just wrong for vulnerable adults, no matter how they vote.
Senator Keogh.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, what I'm concerned about is that this is a broad brush for specific individuals, and that it's including a lot of folks that may have limited medical capacity, but they're 18 years of age and they're eligible to vote, and they know their mind when it comes to who they want to support. And I'm just wondering if this isn't taking a little more than the Constitution is saying it does with the limited guardianships.
Senator Gazelka.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Kielash and members, it really is giving the courts responsibility to bring more clarity to this issue. I mean, it's you know, clearly guardianship should define that you can't vote according to Article 7 of the Constitution, but there's more people in different situations today, which is why we want to have limited guardianship. We want to be able to say there's a whole bunch of people that ought to be voting, that they're in a class where they absolutely should be voting, but we want more distinction, and we want people to follow up that when they are truly under guardianship and shouldn't be voting, that everybody knows it, that there's a responsibility from the guardian and the facility and everybody involved, that we say this, you know, this list is, they should not be voting. And so we're not taking them to a place and having them cast a vote, however they cast a vote.
Senator Gazelka, could you kind of explain to me, I'm looking at 10-6, where you start this annual review, how much of this is being done now, and are you riding on existing procedure, or is a lot of this new?
Mr. Chair, it is riding on the same procedure. I need to go to my other notes here. Most of that is hang on 1 second. There already is quite a bit of reporting, Mr. Chair, but this one, an order by the court under this paragraph may modify, or no, I'm sorry, I'm reading the wrong part there. But it is bringing a little bit more clarity and a little more information that has to be given there. But there already is that annual reporting where they have to talk about a variety of different issues. Right now, the courts, you can bring clarity too, but the courts deal with a lot of other issues already. This is one more that we want clarity to.
As far as their ability to vote specifically.
Mr. Chair, what?
As far as their ability to vote, yes. Specifically. Thank you. Senator Eaton.
I guess as to, I have to say that I can't support this bill. You're talking about our courts having to review 23,000 individuals' guardianship status and whether they can vote every year and send a report in. Unless we're adding some funding to the judicial system, I don't think that that's a very good idea. Plus, there's a lot of people I think are going to have their right to vote taken away simply because that's not possible.
Senator.
Mr. Chair, Senator Eaton, there is already an annual report that's required, so we're adding another component to that. But I believe, at least when I heard the testimony in the House side, that the courts, long-term care providers, and aging services were supportive of this. The Disability Law Center, I believe, was not. There was another group that was concerned about it, but we added an amendment that alleviated that. But there may be others that want to testify and maybe bring some more clarity.
Should we proceed with testimony? Is anyone else care to testify for or against Senate File 1753 of Mr. Ashley Workman? Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the tape, please?
Thank you. My name is Ben Ashley Workman. I am a Policy and Outreach Associate at Mental Health Association of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for hearing our testimony. I will just start briefly by mentioning that I don't know if he is here today to testify, but before the House, Robert McLeod, who is one of the lawyers who really is an architect of Minnesota's current guardianship law, offered extended commentary on some of the issues with this bill, and I would urge you to speak with your House colleagues and look at that. As an organization, we have two serious concerns about the bill as it stands. Our first concern is with the potential for confusion. The language currently used is clear and concise. It's easily understood by those who are affected and concentrates at the fact at hand. Does the person have the right to vote? The new language is not as clear and creates an additional question that must be answered. What kind of guardianship do I have? Perhaps it is clear to us in this room, but it may not always be as clear when interpreted by voters and election judges around the state. I've always appreciated the seriousness and gravity with which election judges I've interacted with have treated that oath. They solemnly detail the prohibitions involved and the need for me as the voter to swear to those facts with total sincerity. They have always erred to caution when there were any issues of eligibility or established residence. We ask that election officials and the public be allowed to keep the language they have. It is clear and it works. We believe that a person coming to the wrong conclusion, voting improperly, or deciding not to vote despite retaining those rights is more likely with this new language. And between these two outcomes, we believe that the latter is more likely. These disenfranchisements will be quiet. They will not be reported to the Secretary of State under the Help America Vote Act. They will simply be people around the state who resign themselves to less involvement in their community. As already noted, the rush of renewals will create an additional problem. These changes will need to be ratified by a court, and a mass of rubber-stamped applications seems to be the most likely outcome, not maximum self-reliance and independence as the statute calls for. And I will note that the change in 2003 was to bring our law in compliance and to parallel current law in other states and around the nation. As guardianship has evolved, it has changed significantly, and we recognize more the rights of people with disabilities. We currently lack language and statute to help guide the courts and individuals on what limited guardianship would be. This redefines the category of guardianship, which now means least restrictive means necessary, to take the meaning of highly restrictive. The second concern we have is with that annual reporting mechanism. Many guardians have limited knowledge of their ward's abilities. The legislature has heard testimony on this issue last year that mentions the significant number, I believe it's over 2,000 wards, that Commissioner Jessen is legally responsible for as of this moment. This might be the high number for the state, but she is far from the only one with multiple wards. We have a greater level of trust with loving family members and good social service organizations who undertake this work, but there are less noble reasons for a person to become a guardian. An individual might choose to go into business and have 40 or 50 wards. They will know little about that person's individual ability to vote. Cases of abuse are widely known and reported in the mainstream press. Taking away the power to vote is one more way in which a ward can be unfairly treated. There's already a financial incentive for a guardian to say that the ward needs to remain under guardianship. Why not also add that the person is incapable of voting? The courts have provided a level of review insufficient to prevent those financial and other abuses we have seen. They make decisions as best they can in limited amounts of time. We are concerned that this requirement to explicitly determine voting rights may encourage guardians to say no, to err on the side of taking away more rights. The law for guardianship calls for least restrictive means necessary, and that's something we at Mental Health Association Minnesota really want to celebrate. People with mental illnesses, even if they require guardianship, still have a great deal of knowledge about how they want to live their lives, what they want for themselves, their communities. This bill will create additional confusion and formally remove the right to vote from those who have held it previously, and we respectfully ask that this bill not advance from committee. Thank you.
Mr. Ashley Wortman, you described a potential rubber stamp operation. I'm just looking at line 1015. The right to vote may not be rescinded without a hearing, so in order to rescind it, they would have to have a special hearing in addition to what they're normally the process they're doing normally every year, relating, as I understand it, relating to the board's capacity or incapacity.
There are two concerns there, and the first is the timeline. There is a very short gap between when this law goes into effect and when that status change has to be changed or ratified in order for the person to retain the right to vote. So that's the first issue. The second is, as I mentioned, they're already strained by the work that we're asking them to do, and this is one more additional burden that we're afraid that is going to be incompletely done in some cases.
Any other questions for the witness? Okay, thank you. Senator Gazelka, do you have anyone else here to testify for or against Ms. Fraser? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. And I just wanted to provide some clarity about current law and that the events described in Crow Wing County are already in violation of current law. Current law is very clear about who can assist a voter and the circumstances under which they can assist the voter, the assistance they're allowed to provide. And it's very clear that someone assisting a voter may not induce or persuade or tell the voter for whom to vote. We have distributed information about assisting voters and have tried to make clear that the voter needs to be able to indicate to the person assisting them how they want the ballot marked. So if I cannot indicate to you who I want to vote for, then you cannot assist me. I have to be able to tell you. You can't say, oh, well, I know you would want to vote for XYZ. I have to be able to indicate that. So the alleged events in Crow Wing County are already in violation of current law. And I just want to be sure that that's clear and on the record. And if there's an issue with that, I mean, that is current law. The piece of this bill that that I think is most needed is the piece of notification of facilities, so that people working with folks under guardianship are aware of whether or not they have the right to vote, because that seems to be an area of some confusion. So I just wanted to get those comments on the record.
Thank you. Senator Gazalka, did you have
Mr. Chair, just quickly, that's why I have the letter from the district attorney there, because he lays out the problem that he was dealing with related to enforcement. And so I think it would be helpful for everybody to have that, because it clarifies that it's not quite where it is right now. And I'll tell you, when I was in the House watching it presented there, it was definitely bipartisan support. You know, we want to get something that I think is going to be beneficial. So I'm certainly willing to work with the parties involved in their concerns.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Anyone else care to testify for or against Senate File 1753? Any further discussion among members? Seeing none, the chair will move Senate File 1753 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed and be referred to Judiciary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next bill on the agenda is Senate File 2296. Senator Chamberlain. Your bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. We have an amendment, if I may.
It's Senator Chamberlain moves his A2 amendment to Senate File 2296. Everyone have the amendment? It should be in your packet.
Mr. Chair, it is an author's amendment.
Discussion to the amendment? All in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Chamberlain.
Mr. Chair and members, this relates to absentee balloting and an administrative change to the process of absentee ballots for military and overseas voters. Currently, what they do for these ballots is on the outside of the ballot, there's a certification. They have to sign and date that certification. That's in statute now for the overseas and military ballots. That statutory language is not currently applied to regular absentee ballots. The regular absentee ballots that's only an administrative rule. So we're trying to do here is a couple of things. We're trying to bring those two areas, make them more consistent, and then remove some unnecessary process that will eliminate some errors and rejections of ballots. So just briefly, we don't believe the date serves a purpose, because the ballots are already available at a certain time, a defined period. The ballots have to be received by election day, so the front end time frame and then the deadline on election day. Asking for the date leads, as I mentioned, to confusion about whether the ballots should be rejected if the voter writes down the wrong date, wrong month, wrong year. And the data we got from this SOS office, 562 absentee voters had their ballots rejected in 2010 because they lacked a date. 377 were able to cast a replacement ballot that was counted. 185 did not. I understand also that the courts have ruled that if those dates are wrong, if there's a discrepancy or if it's missing, it's grounds for rejection of the ballot. So again, we're trying to make some things consistent between overseas military ballots with regular absentee ballots, as well as removing some potential errors and oversights that, frankly, we believe are not needed and we can be avoided.
So
With that, I'll let Ms. Fraser say a couple words.
Hey, Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. Senator Chamberlain ably described the reason for the bill, and the bill basically just removes the requirement that the certificate be dated, and the author's amendment strikes a line that's currently part of the oath that refers to the date and adds an effective date so that it's effective for the full absentee ballot period for the primary. So that's the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any further discussion? Does anyone else care to testify for or against Senate File 2296? Seeing none. Senator Chamberlain renews his motion that Senate File 2296 be recommended to pass and re-referred to general orders. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The bill is referred to general orders.
This is less government.
I can only go so far.
Senator Cruz.
I have my limits. If it was a Sieben bill.
Senator Cruz, welcome to the committee. You have an amendment, the A2.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Yes, at this time I'd love to move the A2 delete everything amendment.
Senator Cruz moves the A2 delete everything amendment. Senate File 2179. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the amendment say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Amendment's adopted. Senator Cruz, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We're looking at Senate File 2179. Essentially, what this legislation does is require legislative oversight over the budget of the Metropolitan Council. At this time, I'd like to just kind of briefly walk you through the amendment, which is now the legislation. Essentially, what the amendment does in general is it requires the legislative oversight of the Metropolitan Council, and it also changes the council's fiscal year to match up with that of the state's fiscal year. So what you see in Section 1 there, as we lean on the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Oversight for recommendations concerning this budget, we now require that they meet at least once per calendar year. In order to take a look at that budget and make recommendations both to the council and to the legislature. Section 2, essentially what that does is that makes that requirement happen by February 15th of each year so that we can meet those deadlines. Section 3 is kind of the meat and potatoes of switching over that fiscal year. We kind of walked through that. Probably an important piece, starting at line 1.32 on the A2 amendment and going to line 2.22, essentially what this says is that if the final budget is not authorized by the legislature, this gives permission to the council to continue to operate at a level no greater than the previously approved budget that has already been enacted. We move on to Section 4. This is kind of the heart of the bill. This is making that a requirement that the legislature does have oversight. And then Section 5 is strictly setting up a transitional budget. What that's going to do is that's going to help that move from the state fiscal year from where the Metropolitan Council's fiscal year is right now. Essentially, Mr. Chair and members, kind of looking at some of the recommendations that have come forward from the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Oversight and also some of the things that we've seen in the auditor's report, kind of requiring more elected officials to participate in this process, a little bit more transparency. This legislation was also included in legislation that was just recommended by the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Government Oversight. So that's kind of where this is coming from. And with that, I'll stand for any questions, open it up to any testifiers.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. And is anyone in the audience care to testify for or against the bill?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Judd Shetton, the Government Affairs Director of the Metropolitan Council. And before I provide my testimony, I'd like to ask Senator Cruz, he talked about the meat and potatoes of the amendment on lines 1.32, lines 2.22. How would that affect the state's general fund and the debt service and the other funds that the council uses moving forward when you're talking about a budget that we get set by the legislature, especially for our transit and our parks funding? I'm trying to figure out how that would work.
I guess, Mr. Chairman and members, could you be a little bit more specific about your concerns?
Mr. Chair, yeah, I'm talking specifically about the funds that we receive from the general fund for our parks operations, for our transit funds.
I guess if I could ask legal staff, as far as I am aware, part of that transitioning budget would make sure that those line up, so there should be no incongruency between the two budgets at that point.
Stengel?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I apologize if I don't entirely answer your question. I was working on another question. I think that you're correct that it does seek to line everything up. There is a transition schedule in Section 5, so that might sort of create a weird year. And Judd is shaking his head at me, so I misunderstood the question.
I don't think it. Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I with the legislature who has to debate that part of our budget, I don't believe that a transit, just allowing that language there, works. That those are general funds that the legislature comes back and debates every year for both our transit general fund and our parks general fund operating. And I know that you can't, at least as far as I know, you can't make determinations for future legislatures. But with that, I just think that technically that's a problem with the bill, but the council doesn't support this legislation anyway. I have a lot of testimony here. I'll try to be quick. First of all, the council opposes the requirements that the legislature annually approve the council's budget and change the council fiscal year from a calendar year to a fiscal year. The current governance structure of the council already ensures that public accountability and transparency, and adding the additional layer of legislative approval, we believe is redundant. It's also worth noting that the state's general fund appropriations to the council make up less than 10% of our total operating budget, and a much smaller portion of our combined operating and capital budgets when you look at the two together. User fees, constitutionally dedicated tax revenues, federal funds, grants from local governments, and local levies, which are also less than 10% of our overall operating budget, are some of the varied revenue sources in the council's budget. And I should also point out that the legislature also sets our levy limits for our property tax levies. The legislative approval for all these state funds, including the constitutionally dedicated funds, already exists through the normal legislative process. And such, this change does not provide the state legislature any additional authority over state funding. Instead, it adds state authority over funds that are not originated at the state level. Final authority from the council's budget is removed from its regional governing body, comprised of members who regularly attend local meetings with constituents and government officials, and who meet at least twice monthly to undertake council business, and more frequently in subcommittees, and as a result are committed and equipped to understand the balance of issues across the metropolitan region. There is no similar requirement being considered for counties and cities, which, like the Metropolitan Council, are political subdivisions of the state. City and county funding mechanisms and interests are too local and too fluid to manage through an annual approval structure at the state level. It is impractical to distance local budget approval from the day-to-day policy considerations of local government. And the same is true for regional governance. State statutory requirements already exist to ensure the accountability and transparency of the state's political subdivisions, and like cities and counties, the Metropolitan Council is subject to these requirements and more. Under current law, the council must meet all of the transparency, meaning the open meeting law requirements, of other subdivisions, and additionally bring our budget to the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Governance, which then has the opportunity to monitor, review, and make recommendations on the council levies, debt, budgets, and overall work role. This oversight requirement uniquely applies to the Metropolitan Council and is not a requirement of cities and counties. Now, once again, it's our position that the council provides active and transparent regional governance, and the current oversight of the Oversight Commission and the legislative process is sufficient. Now, regarding changing the council from a calendar year to a fiscal year, we believe that that would add significant and unnecessary expense for transitioning accounting and reporting changes and changes to current financial documents and agreements, as well as for related staff time and necessary support of these changes. In addition, we believe the transition would require a second financial audit in the transition year to honor bond covenants that require annually audited financial statements. And current financial statements cost us about $200,000 a year. Changing fiscal years would also require that proposed levies be developed 2 years in advance rather than during the year preceding the levy. By January 14th, we would be required to present the state fiscal year 2015 budget and the 2015 payable levy because the state fiscal year extends to June 30th, 2015. While this can technically be done, it's not ideal given that either the potential revenue changes that can be at the federal, state, and local levels during the year between the budget is presented and when the property taxes are levied and the budget is finally executed. Now, I had a couple other comments here, but it changed relating to the amendment. So we do have significant concerns about this bill. We feel it is unnecessary. The state already has review and sets our levies. We negotiate the transit and parks general fund funds through the legislature every year, and we think that this is just a bill that we can't support.
Mr. Shetland, you're saying that somehow the appointed members of the Met Council are somehow comparable to elected members in local units of government?
Mr. Chair and members, we're stating that those members who sit on the council are appointed by the governor, they're confirmed by the Senate, they receive those positions based on coming from districts where they know their constituencies, they work with their cities, and all of the authorities that the Metropolitan Council members have are given to them by the state legislature, and the current council supports this bill, or supports the current structure that we have, especially through the budget process that we have set up, because again, less than 10% of our funds come through the state general fund. Everything else is done through fees or through pass-through funds for our HRA. We receive funds from our CTIB partners. We receive funds a variety of other ways, and we believe that the way that we operate and move through the state financial process is completely sufficient.
Mr. Shetland, the council may be very supportive of itself, but I can assure you my constituents and elected officials in my district don't share that level of support that you're describing for the Metropolitan Council from our view. Senator Cruz, did you have any comments or other witnesses?
I do have another witness that I'd like to bring up, but before that, just a couple of quick comments to follow up Mr. Shetland's testimony here. First of all, I think it's important to remember that currently, up until this year, the Legislative Commission on Oversight, which would provide the oversight that Mr. Shetland is referring to, has not met. I believe it was the previous 4 years. And so I definitely have seen where other legislatures have fallen down on this, and therefore the need to make this a requirement. I also think that it's important to remember that the areas of funding that Mr. Shetland is referring to, specifically with the transit piece and the pieces that are already approved every year, are a small piece of this overall budget. That a very large piece of the Metropolitan Council's budget comes from things like pass-through dollars and such, which, you know, if you ask me, in my opinion, we have sub-entities of this council with elected officials on it that make it possible for this metropolitan body to even perform as that and get those dollars. Yet I think you would be hard-pressed to say that they actually have a firm voice at the table with that. I think it's important to remember that we're talking about billions of dollars a year, or billions of dollars of budget here that are being spent. So I guess those are just a couple of my follow-up comments.
Senator Kalish, did you have a question?
Yes. Senator Cruz, I'm not sure I understand the advantage to switching from the fiscal year to the calendar year. This is because it seems like you're trying to change the Met Council into the same calendar as a local unit of government instead of like a state agency that it is.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Kalish, that's exactly right. The reason for that, and normally I would, you know, if it was possible, just leave it as is, but to line that up so the legislature would be able to take a vote and have that in a timely fashion, that was necessary.
Senator Kalish.
Just to follow up with the Mr. St. John?
Oh, no, I was going to ask to have other comments, Mr. Chair.
Well, okay. Just, you know, I'm not sure I get the, you know, the advantage. Could you explain a little better why the current system works better than trying to go to the local government? I know you talked about setting property taxes or whatever as part of it, but it seems to me that it adds to the confusion for us here in the legislature as well as to how to do funding for the Met Council.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kalish, I agree with you. I think that it is confusing that way. Again, we go through the process of setting our levies based on the structure that the legislature allows us to do that. That is current law. So we feel that transitioning for the purposes of having additional oversight over funds that the legislature currently has oversight over is unnecessary. I'd also like to add, Mr. Chair, that the legislative auditor in their report that Senator Cruz spoke to did not mention this in their letter. And we also talked about the Oversight Commission talking about this. This proposed legislation was revealed last week in a meeting of the Oversight Commission. Now, Senator Cruz is correct that the Oversight Commission has not met for many years. That is the responsibility of the legislature to call those meetings. And the chairmanship of the commission transfers from the House to the Senate, I believe, every year. So that is a decision of the legislature to make that, and the council has no authority over when they meet.
Okay, further testifiers. And then while they're coming up, Senator Lemmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cruz, could you explain this observation that there is no oversight committees being meeting? How long did that go on?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lemmer, I know that it has been at least for a few years. I believe it was 4 years. So three or 4 years, Mr. Chairman and members.
Mr. Chair, whether it's three or four, if there's someone that's designated with a responsibility to an oversight role, somebody's laying down on the job. And we can argue about the number of years, whether it's 1 year or 2 years or even one meeting. I guess I'm kind of concerned that there's a responsibility that's in law and it's not being done. This kind of reminds me of a few years ago, the Metropolitan Gang Strike Task Force that had legislative members on their oversight committee, and the legislators didn't even show up for over 2 years. And we know where that mess went. And then we had to clean it up in the legislature, and it was a product of the legislature, just like this role was. So I'm all for having oversight, but more importantly, if we write the law that we're going to have oversight, someone should be held accountable to that because that's their job.
I think, Senator Lemmer, with this version of the bill, then the legislature would have to meet to adopt the budget or there wouldn't be one.
Right.
So this might be maybe it's oversight, maybe it's accountability that the legislature needed for itself, but other testifiers.
Mr. Chairman and members, just very quickly before we move on to that, to address the auditor's report here. I mean, we heard testimony in this committee from the auditor recommending that there be elected representation. We take a little bit different spin on this as just providing that representation through the legislature, but that was definitely one of the concerns that was brought up by the auditor, and I think it's just important that we keep that on the table.
Clearly, Senator Cruz. Okay, and your testifiers, who would you like to...
Okay, be quick. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. Again, I know I've said this in this committee before, but we represent cities in the 7-county metropolitan area, and one of our key duties is to serve as the city watchdog for the Metropolitan Council. We do have some concerns with the bill. While we support legislative oversight of the Metropolitan Council, we think this bill takes that oversight to a level that is not clear to us how. Our focus is always on how do we enhance the local input into the Met Council processes, and from our perspective, this bill does not go far to do that. It does deal, as Mr. Shetland pointed out, with oversight of many funds that are not state general funds. They're locally generated funds, and so our goal is always how do we increase the local accountability, the transparency and accountability to local officials. Our approach at Metro Cities would be to have a process that our policy support enhancing the selection process for Metropolitan Council members to increase the local input into those processes. And we think that's how we get to having more interaction between the Metropolitan Council and local officials. And we do have several specific policies that would advance those particular goals. With that, I would stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Seeing none. Senator McGuire, did you have a question?
Well, I'll wait, Mr. Chair. I'll wait for more testimony.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members, I think we have one more testifier.
Ms. Meeks?
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and thank you, Senator Cruz, for the opportunity to talk about these two important pieces of legislation. My name is Annette Meeks, and I'm here as a former 8-year member of the Metropolitan Council. I had the privilege of serving on the council from 2003 until last March as an appointee of Governor Pawlenty. During those years, I served as vice chairman of the Community Development Committee as well as chairman of the Transportation Committee. And finally, in 2003, just for background, I convened a task force at a think tank to study and make recommendations on a 21st century Metropolitan Council and what that would look like. Volunteer task force consisted of folks with experience in local government, private development, and with the council. Its purpose was not to eliminate the Met Council, but instead provide a thoughtful guide for policymakers like you interested in repurposing the council after its initial 30 years of existence. I'll make my comments very brief on the budget, only because it was one of the most frustrating things we did as a council. Number one, we would oftentimes, when the Oversight Committee was meeting, be called to talk about some of the budget proposals that we had that were not necessarily in line with the legislature or the governor. There was just a disconnect between oftentimes the policy objectives of the Met Council and what the governor had proposed, or frankly, what, for example, the Transportation Committees of both bodies would be proposing. Secondly, there was always a great deal of concern about how the council spent our money. Even the 10% that we receive in state funds, there was oftentimes we would be called up here after the fact to justify major expenditures, frankly, because the legislature had no idea what we were doing, which leads me to the big one, greater transparency for taxpayers in the region. Legislative oversight is not optional for other state agencies, and even though we're a political subdivision, a different animal, if you will, there still needs to be that oversight. Every year we would have our budget hearings under Minnesota's laws, and we would sit there for the designated hour, and no one would oftentimes show up. No one. which would mean that no one was asking us the hard questions, and frankly, the entire process was staff-driven, with the legislature having zero input. And frankly, the public had little input, even though we did all the meeting notices and the truth and taxation hearings notices. There would still just be crickets chirping in the room while we waited for someone to show up, and oftentimes there would be many years no one. With all of that said, I'll be very brief. I think there's always a good reason for greater accountability, and this is an opportunity for greater accountability and, frankly, greater buy-in by the legislature and the Met Council's activities. I think whenever you have more transparency, more sunshine, and more accountability, that's a good thing, and that's why I'm here today, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Eaton.
I guess my concern with the whole thing is, I don't know if I'm right, but the funding mechanisms that come through and the funding streams that come through the Met Council, a lot of them are already allocated under my understanding to either housing or whatever. How would that go with having the legislature then make a decision about them?
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Eaton, this would simply be an approval. The council would still put together their own budget, decide how to allocate that. Essentially, what we're doing is presenting the legislature with an opportunity to give an up or down vote on whether they approve those budgets. So that would not change. They would still have the ability to write that budget, decide where those go.
Senator Eaton.
Don't you think it would be easier if we just had the legislature do their part that they're already assigned? I mean, to me, that would solve the problem, is that we just made sure that the House or Senate, whoever's responsible, would do their due diligence on that committee.
Senator Eaton, when the DFL was in charge, they never met. That was the problem.
I wasn't here.
I'm not blaming you. I know you weren't. Senator Meeks. I mean, Ms. Meeks, I'm sorry. Did you have a comment? Or you look like you had some.
Mr. Chairman, in response to Senator Eaton's question,
yes,
I think the most important thing is you often find out about things that are happening, especially major budget expenditures, after the fact. I can think of, and I'm sure Mr. Shettinen still has nightmares about our last bus procurement and the literal nightmare that was created. We were using federal procurement standards, as we're required to do at the council by law, and yet there was confusion by many legislators when you see a giant multi-million dollar procurement like that going through and a Minnesota company filing a complaint. That certainly got the attention of many legislators. Unfortunately, that action had already been taken by us, and frankly, the terrific staff at Met Council had done a great job steering us through the process. We had no problems with the processes that we had used, yet the legislature found out after the vote had been taken, after the protest had been filed, and left a lot of confusion that I think in at least having regular oversight, and frankly, you would have known had you approved our budget that that was something we were going to be purchasing. And you see that giant multi-million dollar expenditure coming through, even though it's federal pass-through dollars, it would have got your attention, I guarantee you, before it was after the fact. And if I may just add one other thing I forgot to mention, Mr. Chairman, and that was not only did the Legislative Oversight Committee not meet, but during my last four-year term, we were never confirmed by the Senate.
Mr. Shetland.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm here to answer questions about the procurement piece. What happened there was that, yes, we were moving forward with a large procurement. There was an issue, however, with we have some bus companies in the state of Minnesota who create buses that we purchase, articulated buses and the such. And the issue there was they were interested in putting in legislation that dealt with providing a local preference to have Minnesota-made buses. And under federal law, we cannot do that. When you receive federal monies, you cannot provide a local preference, and that's what that issue was. I respect former council member Meeks on that, but I don't believe the issue was regarding the money. I think it had to do with where that contract was let.
Mr. Shetland, have you talked to Senator Cruz about the perceived difficulty you have in the transition part of this?
Mr. Chair, I have not. I have been reviewing the bill. We can certainly continue that conversation, but I do believe, and I'm happy to be corrected, that if the state general funds are set by the future legislatures for the upcoming bienniums, that this bill allowing us to move forward with those funds is, we cannot do that by law. Otherwise, just like we went through this last session with setting the budget, and the House and Senate had very different situations about, than the administration and how bus operations would move forward, we would not have been we wouldn't have had that issue if we could have gone forward with the current budget. And I think that takes all of that out of the hands of the legislature. And that is the part of the, those are the state funds, other than a small piece of a general fund that go to the park system, that the legislature reviews and we deliberate every year, in, or every other year. And if you take that those funds out and allow them to be set, that is, you know, I think you'd find some people that would be willing to take that. But I don't think that the future legislatures would necessarily want to allow that to occur.
Well, Senator Cruz, maybe that issue can be worked out on the way to finance, because this doesn't look like it has to go to finance.
Mr. Chair, members, just like that, I'm not sure we want to try to if we don't support this bill anyway, I'm happy to talk to Senator Cruz about that transition, but I just want to be clear the council doesn't support the bill anyway.
Okay, Mr. Chair, King George and Parliament didn't support some of the stuff that happened when they were doing taxation without representation, too. At any rate, Senator Cruz renews his moves that Senate file, 2179, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No.
No. No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed and re-referred to Finance. We will reconvene at 6:30 tonight in room 107 across the hall.
Mr. Chair?
One bill?
So thank you. Yes.
Are we just doing the remaining bill that's on the calendar, on the agenda, or anything else?
Why don't we just do it? We need to do it. Let's just do it. Can we, should we try to do it now? Do members it. Prefer to do that?
Yep.
Okay. So I'll take that reconvene back, and we'll take a run at 2014. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I will try and make this as brief as possible. I think this one's probably going to be a lot quicker than the last one, I hope, anyway. Essentially, what this is doing is this is setting up the Metropolitan Council for staggered terms. I do have one quick amendment to offer. If it would please the chair at this time, I would like to move the A1 amendment.
Senator Cruz moves the A1 amendment. This is to get the bill in the shape you'd like it in. Okay, discussion to the A1 amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Just a real brief description. What this does is it staggers half and half the terms of those members of the Metropolitan Council. And essentially the amendment we just added on as we were writing the language, we did take out on line 1.18 of the original bill, a member serves at the pleasure of the governor. We wanted to make sure that there were still opportunities to remove members. So that's where we have the amendment in. And with that, I will stand for any questions and testimony.
Thank you. Any discussion? Senator Steven.
Thank you. Senator Cruz, could you explain who can remove the member from
Senator
office?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Steven. With that, I think maybe a better person to describe this would be counsel. I know that we went back to language that we used throughout statute to remove appointed members.
Ms. Tangle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cruz and Senator Steben. Usually it is by the appointing entity that can make this type of removal. In this case, it's not specified, as you can see. So it could be likely clarified. I apologize, Senator Cruz, for missing that piece of it. It could be done by the governor who makes the appointment or the committee itself when they see these sorts of things going on.
And Mr. Chairman and members, I would maybe ask council to just take a second and recommend some language that we might be able to use. And then with that, I would also like to say that we still throughout this have Senate oversight over the members of the council as far as having that up and down approval. None of that changes.
Okay. Ms. King, do you have some language or?
Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, the language that we were borrowing this from applies to the Metropolitan Airport Commission, and that statute talks about the appointing. Read it to you, actually. It says that a commissioner may be removed from office by the appointing body or person. So in this case, that would be the governor. A person could be removed for these things upon motion of the governor, and then they'd still have the notice and the charges as provided. So if that's how you'd like the amendment to read, I can do an oral amendment for you.
Ms. Nail, how hard would that be to get it in writing?
To have it back by 3 o'clock, I'm not sure we could do that. It would just be adding a few words, Mr. Chair.
Is everybody okay with doing it orally? Okay.
Mr. Chair, just a question for Ms. Nail. Doesn't the language that's deleted in 1.18, a member serves at the pleasure of the governor, do exactly the same thing? If we left that language in there, the governor could get rid of a member for malfeasance or any other reason? So essentially what you're doing is putting a longer sentence in that does the same thing as the one that's being deleted in 1.18.
Ms. Dangle.
Senator Kielash, the language that we're putting in the A1 amendment is a bit more, puts more parameters around it. They can only be removed for misfeasance, malfeasance, or nonfeasance. The language as it is, the governor can just say, okay, I don't like you anymore, you're out for no apparent reason. So this is a little bit more of a strict standard in the amendment.
I think that would kind of negate the staggered term concept if the governor could just fire him for no reason. So they're putting in reasons so that they would be a little more autonomous, maybe. Senator Cruz.
No, Mr. Chairman, you took the words right out of my mouth.
Mr. Shetton, you're jumping up. Did you want to talk?
We're ready. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. These will be nice and short compared to my previous comments. So, the council supports the coterminous and serving at the pleasure structure of the governor terms that are in place today. We are and have stated many times that we're open to have a discussion regarding the council's governance structure. We feel that the discussion must include all regional stakeholders and weigh the impacts of any proposed governance model, including staggered terms. And that discussion must also include the council's taxing authorities and other statutory responsibilities that we hold, meaning implementing the Metropolitan Land Planning Act, transit planning and operations, our roles as the Metropolitan Planning Organization, how we issue our livable communities grants, how we operate the regional wastewater system, and the planning and development of our regional park system. We think all of these things need to be taken into place, and we've stated that many times. We talked about that last year when we came to talk about the transit governance study that the auditor presented. And again, I would just like to state that we're happy to have that conversation about council governance, but we feel that you have to take the time and do a comprehensive and inclusive study with all regional stakeholders prior to making any of these governance structure changes. So thank you.
Mr. Shetland, did you have some language, Ms. Dangle? Should we get that amendment done?
Yeah, I have it, Mr. Chair. It would be to the A1 amendment on line 1.3 after office. The phrase by the appointing body or person would be inserted. So the sentence would read, a member may be removed from office by the appointing body or person for misfeasance, malfeasance, and then the sentence continues.
A discussion to the amendment. Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. And the amendment is adopted. Senator Rumley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would think that this would make continuity so much easier for the council if you don't have almost everybody coming on new, which could conceivably happened, and I think almost happened recently when we did have a new governor. And it can happen both ways, members. I mean, the next governor who's elected could be a Republican, and then he's going to have a certain number of continuing appointees from the previous administration. But each would have to deal with that. But I think that having that continuity is often helpful. Certainly the governor would have the majority of the members. I believe that. Is that the way you set it up, Senator Cruz, that the an incoming governor would be able to have the majority of members appointed at the time, because they'd appoint the chair and half of the members besides the chair?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Senator Roblin.
So, you know, from that point of view, that they could have people who would share their philosophy. But I just think, for continuity's sake, and I often think the Senate should do the same thing, we should have staggered terms as well. It gets a little messy, though, because we have to be redistricted every 10 years, and so it causes some complications. But I just think that I've always thought this would be a good idea, and so I thank you for bringing it forward.
I think it's the kind of reform our constituents have been looking for, too, nonpartisan. They're a little more bipartisan implementation. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cruz, why are you taking out the language that requires a council member to live in the district they represent?
Senator
Does
Cruz.
Congresswoman Bachman want to?
It's a member district.
Mr. Chairman and members.
Senator Cruz.
When we had this, I guess I would ask council to speak to that, whether the necessity to strike that line.
Ms. Tangle.
Mr. Chair and Senator Cruz, I wasn't involved in authoring this, so I can't quite tell you why that language was removed. Perhaps it's somewhere else in statute. I can't quite point my finger anywhere, so if we take it out, it seems like that requirement may be gone entirely from law.
With that, Mr. Chairman and members, I would be comfortable re-including that language to make sure that these members are representing their own districts. I mean, if that's a concern, I think that's valid, and I would move to put that back in there.
Senator Cruz moves to put back to undelete the deleted language. Do you want to give us the
sure, Mr. Chair? The amendment would be on lines 10 and 11, reinstate the stricken language, and on line 1.12, reinstate of the council.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
That was a very good catch, Senator Seaman. I would have been very unhappy if that had been permanently eliminated and some of our areas would not be represented at all by someone who lived in the district.
Senator Kalish.
Yes, if I recall, this was presented in the past and passed, I believe, and didn't Governor Pawlenty veto this or something similar to this? Could you explain the reasons for the veto?
Let's get the amendment before we forget.
I'm sorry.
I just should have caught it. Okay, Senator Cruz. Or Senator Sieben moves that. Can you give us the?
Yes, Mr. Chair. On lines 10 and 11, reinstate the stricken language. On line 12, reinstate of the council, period.
So moved by Senator Sieben. Any discussion to that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair and members, Senator Kalish, you are correct. This bill did make its way through the legislature. It was, I think, around 2007, 2008. And Governor Pawlenty, it made its way through the entire House and Senate, and Governor Pawlenty vetoed the legislation. Mm-hmm. I don't have the specifics. I know one of the issues that was left him, I guess, a bit concerned was the removing of a council member for cause and what for cause meant. And I see the amendment that is listed here that was adopted has a little bit more stricter, rationale than what for cause might mean. But I do believe, and I don't want to speak for Governor Pawlenty specifically, but I do think that he was concerned about not having council members that could potentially align himself with his line. Well, actually, looks like Ms. Meeks can speak to that. But mm-hmm. Senator Kielash, yes, the Governor Pawlenty did veto this bill in 2008 for his own rationale.
Thank you. Ms. Meeks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill that you're referring to, I believe, Senator, passed in 2008. It was House File 2662, Senate File 2605 in their conference report. It passed the House 93-35 and the Senate 54-0 and was vetoed by Governor Pawlenty. And Governor Pawlenty, just in what little I could find on his veto message, said it was due to what Judd just said, his concerns about the provision that dealt with removal of a council member. It didn't appear to have anything to do with the staggered terms. It appeared to be some of the vague language that was in the bill.
And I can't speak for the governor, but I think he'd be okay with it.
Which governor?
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually just did have a question on the misfeasance, malfeasance, and nonfeasance. Did you say, Council, that this was taken from a current statute? Is it currently what we do for the Airports Commission? Is that what you said?
Mr. Chair and Senator McGuire, yes, this language is taken from the what we do for the Airport Commission. It's also used elsewhere, this sort of language.
So if I could McGuire. Just get a little clarification. So it's pretty much for almost anything, misfeasance, malfeasance, but it does have to have some cause be documented. Is that what sort of the requirement is that you have to have written charges and have to be heard? Otherwise, the governor can just say you're out.
Ms. Taylor, would you like a few minutes to work on that? Or?
Mr. Chair, Senator McGuire, I can get you further information later about the legal interpretation of what exactly these words mean. I can't tell you off the top of my head. But okay. Basically, you're right. There has to be some reason. It can't be because I'm a new governor and you're of the other party, so you're out. I would have to be, you never come to meetings, or you pilfered some money, or you did something.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Ms. Nauman.
Mr. Chair and members, Patricia Nauman again from Metro Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today. Our organization does support staggered terms for council members. In fact, that was an initiative. The 2008 bill was our initiative. It's a point of consensus that we have among our members and have long had, even when we don't have consensus on other governance issues. I also wanted to the question on Governor Pawlenty's veto, in 2008, we did amend that bill to include the statement that members should serve at the pleasure of the governor as a response to the issue that the governor had raised at the time, but he did still veto the language. I also would like to just quickly point out that our policies do support having the term of the chair be coterminous with the governor. And I don't see that in this legislation, but that's something that our policies would support. Thank you.
Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair, I do think that may be important because otherwise the governor does not have the majority.
Right.
So that we need to do something to amend that in. Because I was thinking it would be less likely to draw a veto if a governor, any governor, would know that he would still be able to appoint the majority of the members, even if it's, 50% plus one. But now if the chair's term is not indicated that it would be coterminous with the governor's, it might not work out that way. Some years it might and some years it might not.
Okay. Ms. Meeks, will you finish with your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief as well. And, of course, the issue we're debating came about in a 1994 change to the Metropolitan Council's governing law. Prior to that, we did have staggered terms. And, again, in 2008, Governor Pawlenty vetoed the provision that would have reinstated those staggered terms. However, as Senator Roebling just pointed out, keeping the chairman term coterminous with the governor has been a consistency throughout both of those pieces of legislation. And one thing I would add to the discussion is recently, 2 years ago, two recent now former chairs of the Met Council called for this modest accountability measure. Chairman Peter Bell, whom I served under, stated that, and I quote, staggered terms should be restored to improve continuity from one administration to the next rather than the rather dramatic changes we've seen in the last three Met Councils. With that, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chairman and members, it's truly my intent to get this legislation passed and signed. So I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm looking for maybe a little bit of direction from you or maybe council on how hard it would be to ensure that chair coterminous language. If we need to temporarily table this, make those corrections to make sure that we can move forward.
Let's just see. Senator Cruz, you could hold 1 second. They think it's already there. They're just trying to confirm that. So we'll give them a few minutes. Senator Kalish.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it goes to the amendment, and it's malfeasance upon written charges and an opportunity to be heard in defense of the charges. It doesn't say what form that would be, the defense would take place. Is that just in a meeting with the governor, or that they're allowed to meet with the governor and say, I messed up, but here's why, or how does this go?
I'm not sure. I looked this up once for the Senate, and it has to do with a judge would have to kind of make a determination. I don't know if that process is part of this, or
Ms. Dingell.
Ms. Dingell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kalish, generally in this sort of situation, there has to be some sort of public hearing, and usually it's before the body, so in this case it would be before the Met Council, unless we provide it otherwise.
So the Met Council would be the ones that would hear the charges, but the governor would have the authority, or is the only one that has the authority to remove that person?
Mr. Chair and Senator Kalish, that's my understanding.
Thanks.
Okay. With regard to the chair of appointment,
they're not going to believe me.
They believe you, Ms. Dingell.
Mr. Chair, provisions relating to the chair being appointed by the governor are in a different subdivision that are not amended in this bill, so it seems that that would still be the case, that the chair would serve the same term as the governor. And we can continue to look at that to make sure that's the case, and if it's not, we can fix it up.
Thank you. Further discussion? Senator Cruz, any parting comments?
Mr. Chairman, I move to table the bill.
Senator Cruz, we could probably lay it over. I don't think we need to.
That would be my desire to lay it over. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Roblin.
Mr. Chair, I think our questions have pretty much been answered. It appears that the authority of the governor to appoint is there. And so I'm just thinking that we wouldn't need an amendment because, and then in addition, the chair doesn't have a numbered district, so they wouldn't necessarily follow under that area. So I don't know if that would matter or not. I mean, if Senator Cruz wants to lay it over.
How do you feel, Senator Cruz, now?
Having that question answered, Mr. Chairman, I would like to move forward with the bill.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves that Senate File 2014 be recommended to pass and referred to the general, sent to the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no.
No. No.
Motion prevails.
Division.
Division.
All in favor of Senate File 2014 be recommended to pass and refer to the general register, say aye, or raise your hand. That's seven. Okay, all opposed? Six. Being seven ayes and six nays, the motion prevails. No further business before the committee. This meeting is adjourned.
Where?
Well, now that I got the phone.
I just asked if you could go second.
Guess who's in politics?
Oh, me? No. Oh my God!
Is you were number five or so?
Wow, that's what happens when you're.
They're trying to get rid of Marty in the worst way. Yeah.
those lobbyists, those business lobbyists, they want to get rid of John.
If you could for just a few minutes, that'd be great. Otherwise, oh
yeah. Comprehensive package.
Yeah. And then it's crap.